and sectarianism, and of course, it's always trying to pit the Persians against the Arabs or the Turks. And isn't the situation actually what is happening with the Islamic Republic's support of the Palestinian cause actually an answer to all of that, that it has nothing to do with being a Shia or being a Persian or not being an Arab, but actually the resistance and being against oppression is actually key for Tehran over anything else?
This is a very good question. People don't read the Iranian constitution that forces Iran to support the oppressed people around the globe. And if we see the behavior of Iran supporting the Palestinians, who are majority Sunnis, supporting the Lebanese, Shia and Sunni, supporting the Syrian, who are majority Sunni, going to Iraq, and the first Iranian plane landed in Erbil in Kurdistan against ISIS, and not only in the Shia area, it has landed in Kurdistan. And Iran going to Venezuela, supporting the Venezuelan population that is oppressed by the Americans for so many years, it showed that Iran has a certain ideology that, notwithstanding all the pressure and all the sanctions, is really abiding by its ideology and abiding by its code, and is really fulfilling this code. Even if Iran is under harsh pressure, it is managing to create allies unconditionally. That is the key of success of Iran. And this is why Iran represents a serious danger to the West.
Okay.
It can't be accused of sectarianism because it's diversity of the support.
All right. I'd love to continue talking about this, but we're out of time. I appreciate both of you being with me. Elijah Magnier out of Brussels, Franck Hughes out of Belfast, both journalists. A pleasure talking to you. And with that, that brings us to the end of this Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details. Here we enlighten you with ayahs 2-4 of Surah Nahl, recited by Murtaza Rahnemal.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. ينزل الملائكة بالروح من أمره على من يشاء أنه لا إله إلا أنا فاتقون خلق السماوات والأرض بالحق تعالى عما يشركون خلق الإنسان من فإذا هو خصيم مبين صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most gracious, the most compassionate, He sends down the angels with inspiration by His commandment, on whom He pleases of His servants, saying, "Give the warning that there is no God but Me. Therefore, be careful of your duty to Me." He created the heavens and the earth with the truth. Highly exalted be He above what they associate with Him. He created man from a small seed, and lo, he is an open contender.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
This hour, Iran categorically rejects a Western media report about enriching uranium to 84% purity, saying that the IAEA should not be used for political purposes. The African Union defends expulsion of a senior Israeli diplomat from his recent summit, saying the regime's observer status at the bloc was suspended. And North Korea says it could turn the Pacific into a firing range as it launches more ballistic missiles in response to joint drills between the U.S. and the South. Well, welcome to our studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is News. Thanks for joining us. Iran has rejected a report by the news website Bloomberg claiming inspectors of the International Atomic Energy Agency have found enriched uranium above 60% purity. Spokesman for the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran, Behruz Kamalvandi, said it is regrettable that the UN nuclear watchdog is being used as a political lever to put pressure on Tehran. He added that Bloomberg's report is aimed at distorting the realities. The spokesman said the existence of uranium particles with over 60% purity level during the enrichment process does not mean that uranium has been enriched at that level. What matters, he said, is the end product, adding that Iran has never enriched uranium to purity levels of more than 60%. In his report, Bloomberg claimed that IAEA inspectors had discovered Iran enriched uranium with a purity level of 84%. Israel has once again carried out fresh strikes in Syria. The attack left behind casualties and destruction amid international silence. Mohammed Ali has more in this report from Damascus.
Another scene of wide-scale destruction in Syria, this time signed by Israel. Israeli fighter jets attacked multiple residential targets in Damascus, killing at least five people and injuring 15 others, with the majority being civilians.
All residents were sleeping in the building. This is a residential neighborhood. The missile landed here. A number of residents were killed and others injured. There are no officials or any prominent figures living here, only ordinary civilians. All apartments were heavily affected.
At 12:15 a.m., we heard loud noises. I asked my mother to step back from the windows. Suddenly, the house shook and we felt an explosion. All windows broke. We asked for help. This is a tragic reality.
The aggression caused significant damage to private property in the heavily populated Kfar Susa quarter in Damascus. Apartments, balconies, and walls collapsed, and nearby cars were affected. Syria's ancient citadel in Old Damascus was also hit. Analysts say Israel's intention for these attacks is to keep Syria in a state of instability.
For 10 years, Israel has been adopting the strategy of strategic battles between wars. The aim is to eliminate any chance of a war on Israel through weakening the enemy. Israel wants Syria to stay in a state of war and instability. This aggression in particular comes as more countries are planning to restore relations with Syria, something Israel wants to foil.
Syria's foreign ministry sent a letter to the UN saying the strikes are part of Israel's systematic aggression against civilians, urging punishment for the crimes committed by the regime. The ministry called for necessary measures to end such aggressions, as well as a clear condemnation from the United Nations Security Council. One shock after another. This is how Syrians live every day, not knowing whether they'll be waking up to an earthquake, act of aggression, or a terrorist attack. All they ask is for the international community to wake up and help ease their unprecedented plights. Hamad Ali, Damascus.
The removal of an Israeli diplomat from a summit of the African Union has triggered controversy. The union says it suspended Israel's observer status at the bloc last year, so no Israeli should have attended in the first place.
We have not invited any Israeli to this assembly. We have noted that somebody entered the hall with a badge. We asked the individual to quickly leave the hall. This is a person who does not reside in Ethiopia, and we are conducting investigations to know how the individual got accredited. Therefore, ladies and gentlemen of the press, we have not invited any Israeli authorities. We are going to push this investigation to the fullest to know where the error was coming from.
Video circulating on social media shows security personnel confronting the Israeli diplomat. That's during the opening ceremony of the summit, before the diplomat leaves the auditorium. Israel has claimed its envoy was an accredited observer and has slammed South Africa and Algeria for the expulsion of the envoy. The regime attained observer status at the bloc in the year 2021. South Africa and Algeria protested the decision at the time. They said it runs counter to the bloc's statements in support of the Palestinians. North Korea has launched more projectiles one day after firing an intercontinental ballistic missile that landed off Japan's coast. South Korean and Japanese militaries say the two short-range ballistic missiles were fired within minutes of each other early on Monday. They reportedly landed outside of Japan's exclusive economic zone. The launch comes one day after joint U.S.-South Korean military drills. In response, the sister of North Korean leader Kim Jong-un warned against increased U.S. presence in the region. She said the North could turn the Pacific into a, quote, firing range, depending on U.S. forces' movements. Tensions are running high on the Korean Peninsula, as the North views America's war games with its regional allies as provocative and rehearsals for an invasion. A correspondent from Seoul, Frank Smith, joins us to tell us more about this. Well, tell us what, Frank, North Korea has fired, and then also regarding the joint war games between the U.S. and Japan. The type of equipment that was used should be indicative of perhaps what type of military operation they might have in mind. if that's a correct reading on it.
Sure, I would say that's a correct reading. Yesterday's missile was apparently an ICBM, a Hwasong-15. That's one of North Korea's longest range missiles. It flew at quite a steep apogee. That means that they fired it almost straight up and then straight down so that it wouldn't go too far. As you mentioned earlier in this report, the missiles launched today landed outside of Japan's exclusive economic zone, likely again being fired at quite a steep angle. North Korea is conducting these missile launches really in response to U.S.-South Korea military exercises, which have started to happen much more under the new South Korean president, Yoon Suk-yeol, who came to office last May. He wants to see the U.S. bring so-called strategic assets to the Korean Peninsula. Those are weapons, ships, aircraft carriers, and B-2 bombers and F-35 bombers, these types of things that can deliver nuclear bombs. He wants to see those come to South Korea more often. And so what we're seeing really is kind of a tit-for-tat chicken game between really North Korea on the one side and South Korea and the U.S. on the other side, really kind of escalating tensions in what many would see is quite a dangerous development, especially when you consider that the errors that have taken place where South Korea lost one missile that had launched, one missile came back last year and landed within 700 meters of a residential area. So there is a risk involved with this increase of tensions here.
Frank Smith, a correspondent from Seoul, we appreciate it. Moving on, the U.S. has accused China of planning to send military assistance to Russia for its war in Ukraine, which is approaching its one-year anniversary. In a TV interview, the U.S. Secretary of State said that any move by Beijing to provide Moscow with lethal support would seriously damage the U.S. relationship with China. Antony Blinken said that he had made it clear to his Chinese counterpart, Wang Yi, during the Munich Security Conference that Beijing would face consequences if it moved ahead with assisting Russia in the war. The U.S.-China ties remain thorny over a host of issues. Tensions escalated recently after the U.S. shot down a Chinese balloon, claiming that it intruded into American airspace for spying. Beijing has dismissed Washington's allegations, with Wang describing the downing of the balloon as hysterical and absurd. Moscow says the U.S. is a, quote, major provocateur of international tensions after Washington expressed support for Ukraine's attack on Russian-annexed Crimea. The Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov said the remarks by American officials about Crimea underscored the depth of disagreement between the two countries. He was responding to the U.S. Under Secretary of State Victoria Nuland, who had also called for Crimea to be demilitarized. Peskov added that Kiev and its Western allies have not shown any willingness to peacefully resolve the conflict in Ukraine. Russia says Western countries are prolonging the war by pouring military aid into the country. The West, however, has ignored the warning. European Union Foreign Policy Chief Josep Borrell has been urging Western countries to provide more military aid to Ukraine.
Zelensky and the Ukrainians have a lot of applaudissement and not enough ammunition. That's the paradox. They need to be less applauded and better supplied with arms. The Ukrainians are fighting, paying the highest price in terms of lives. But this war happens in European soil, affects us, and has a global impact around the world, which also affects our security.
Borrell made the comments at the Munich Security Conference while their Ukrainian officials urged U.S. Congress members to press the administration to send F-16 fighter jets to Kiev. Ukraine says the jets would boost Kiev's ability to hit Russian missile units. Washington has been reluctant to send the warplanes, but the proposal is supported by Congress. The U.S. has provided some $30 billion in military aid to Ukraine since the beginning of the war in February of last year. Moscow has charged 680 Ukrainian officials with war crimes, saying that they have used prohibited means and methods of warfare. The head of Russia's Federal Investigative Authority says the defendants are charged with use of weapons against the civilian population. Those targeted include over 100 commanders of the armed forces of Ukraine and the country's defense ministry. Ukraine has also launched its own criminal proceedings against members of Russia's armed forces for hitting non-military targets. However, both Kiev and Moscow deny attacks on civilians in the year-long conflict. The cost of living crisis in Europe has triggered fresh protests and strikes across the continent. In Spain, thousands of supporters of public health have protested in Madrid over what they call the destruction of the public health system by the conservative regional governments. In Portugal, thousands of teachers have also held rallies in the capital, Lisbon, demanding higher pay and better working conditions. It was the third such protest in less than a month in the European country. Protesters have returned to major cities across Europe to voice their anger at the rising cost of living across the continent. In Spain, people held a massive rally in Madrid against what they call the regional government's dismantling of the public health care system. Officials say 250,000 people turned out, but organizers put the number as high as a million. That is the largest such demonstration in recent months. Protesters accuse the regional government of prioritizing private health. They say the public health service is suffering from staff and equipment shortages because of the government's policies. Some primary care doctors and healthcare workers have also been holding regular strikes over better working conditions and pay.
The condition of the public health system is deteriorating. The number of doctors have been decreasing with medical conditions getting worse. Many medical centers have been closed.
The region's right-wing leader has repeatedly claimed that the protesters are motivated by political interests. And in the Portuguese city of Lisbon, tens of thousands of teachers have taken to the streets amid public discontent over the cost of living crisis. It is the third time in less than a month that teachers and school workers have held mass demonstrations. Teachers want a pay rise and are also calling on the government to speed up career progression. Officials say negotiations with teachers' unions are ongoing and expressed hope that an agreement would be reached soon. Portugal is one of Western Europe's poorest countries, which is seeing decades-high inflation and is grappling with the cost of living crisis.
We are here to claim our rights, which were taken away from us a long time ago. Our careers have been frozen for a long time, and that can't be. We have the right to have a more dignified career. We can't work like this. It just can't be.
In Germany, the travel sector witnessed widespread chaos after a major trade union called on airport workers to go on a strike over pay. And in France, workers staged fresh protests and walkouts against the government's pension reform plans, which would raise the retirement age from 62 to 64. Protests in Spain and Portugal come as passengers across Germany have witnessed widespread travel chaos after a major trade union called on airport workers to go on a strike over a pay dispute. Verdi Trade Union called for the industrial action after it said collective bargaining efforts to settle wage disputes with the government failed. Since last year, European airlines have been facing labor strife amid staff shortages and soaring inflation, which have prompted employees to demand higher wages. German officials say despite a recent improvement, the economy is expected to suffer another mild decline in early 2023, as energy prices for households are still increasing. German consumer prices, harmonized to compare with other European Union countries, peaked at 11.6% in October, driven by the surge in energy prices and rising input costs. In the UK, more than 70% of UK households fear that they will be severely hit by the cost of living crisis in the first part of 2023, up from 54% at the end of last year.
Nobody actually wants to be on strike. We want to do our jobs. We want to look after the students here. This is what our passion is. But we've been driven into a situation where we can't even pay our bills now. So basically, we've been forced to do this. Nobody works in education to be rich, but we'd like to have a decent standard of life. And I think we're losing a lot of staff as well. A lot of people are leaving because of the pay.
Meanwhile, in France, police clashed with people protesting the government's pension reform bill. Hundreds of thousands of people attended the rally, which was held in a number of other cities across France, seeking to keep up pressure on the government over the reform plan, which aims to raise the retirement age from 62 to 64. President Emmanuel Macron says the reform is vital to ensuring the viability of the pension system.
We would like the age of retirement to remain the same. 62 is already enough for working people like us. We work in kindergarten in the way, and we don't see ourselves working with children at 64. It's already quite hard currently, and going farther isn't possible.
This is a democracy, and people only have a month to debate the pension reform. The government has kept its project hidden for months, despite the fact that it was ready, and they only yield on details when people take to the streets. Well, we will keep going.
The economic crises have been compounded by the protracted war in Ukraine. The war has pushed up prices, including the price of commodities like energy products. Furthermore, European nations have pledged billions of dollars worth of military aid to Ukraine. and that has sapped the capacities of European major economies to spend money on social welfare programs. With that, we come to an end for this edition of World News. It's bye-bye for now.
The whole world is silent towards oppression, even one voice becomes powerful. IRIB English Radio, the voice of the voiceless. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en.
Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who allowed none to witness when He created the heavens and the earth, and who took no helper when He authored the spirits. He has no associate in divinity and no support in unity. Tongues fall silent before the limits of describing Him. Intellects fail before the core of knowing Him. Terrents fall low in awe of Him. Faces are humbled in fear of Him. And everything mighty yields to His mightiness. So to Thee belongs praise again and again, well measured, continually and methodically. And may His blessings be upon His messenger endlessly, and His salutation everlastingly, eternally. O Allah, make the beginning of this day of mine righteousness, its middle prosperity, and its end success. I seek refuge in Thee from a day whose beginning is fright, and whose middle is anxiety, and whose end is pain. O Allah, I pray forgiveness from Thee for every vow I have vowed, and every promise I have promised, and every pledge I have pledged, then failed to keep for Thee. I ask Thee concerning the complaints of Thy servants against me. If there is a servant from among Thy servants, of a handmaid from among Thy handmaids, who has against me a complaint, because I have wronged him in respect to himself, his reputation, his property, his wife or his child, or because evil words I have spoken about him in his absence, an imposition upon him through inclination, caprice, scorn, zeal, false show, bigotry, whether he be absent or present, alive or dead, such that my hand has fallen short and my capacity has been too narrow to make restitution to him or to annul my obligation to him, I ask Thee, O He who owns all objects of need which are granted by His will and hastened to His desire, that Thou blessest Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, peace be upon them, and makest the one I have wronged satisfied with me in the manner that thou willst, and givest me mercy from thee. Forgiveness decreases thee not, and giving injuries thee not. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, give me on every Monday two favors from thee: the facility to obey thee at its beginning, and the favor of thy forgiveness at its end. O He who is Allah, and none other than whom grants forgiveness for sins.
Tourism. In the name of God, Salam and welcome to the program. Dear listeners, we are with you with the first episode of a new series, Food Tourism. In this series, we will try to make you briefly familiar with food customs and traditions among different Iranian ethnicities. We hope that you will enjoy this series, and one day you will happen to come to Iran to taste delicious Iranian cuisine. Stay with us, please. Tourism is one of the most lucrative industries in the world. It has found a very important status in the economy and policy of various nations as an effective factor of sustainable development. Sustainable development has been used in the literature of development and has been strongly pursued in developing countries. The World Commission on Environment and Development, WCED, was founded in 1987. In the same year, it released its statement called Our Common Future, whereby it gave a specific definition of sustainable development. WCED says that sustainable development is the development which can fulfill the needs of the present generation without jeopardizing the ability of the next generations in securing their needs. As a matter of fact, sustainable development puts forward solutions to prevent issues such as destruction of natural resources, destruction of biosystems, pollution, climate change, increase of population, injustice, and low quality of life of humans in the present and future. Therefore, activists of tourism try to put tourism within the framework of sustainable development to pay full attention to the environmental, economic, social, and cultural aspects of tourism industry. Tourism industry is an effective factor for decrease of poverty and establishment of social justice. But further development of this industry requires awareness of individuals of various aspects of tourism and its relation with other parameters of sustainable development. Accordingly, tourism has to be planned in a way that, while it is economically profitable, its destructive effect on the environment of the host country reduces to almost zero. Dear listeners, it is interesting to note that tourism has different kinds, such as historical tourism, sports tourism, health tourism, ecotourism, and so on. However, since human beings are interested in new experiences, national and local foods have been highly welcomed by tourists across the world. Food culture and habits of host country have gained importance for many tourists. In other words, food builds a strong bond between the history and culture of the host nation and tourists. Food and drink are today considered as among the main symbols to introduce the culture, tradition, behavior, and ecological views of various ethnicities. Food tourism is an industry and was used in 2001 for the first time. Eric Wolf, manager of the International Tourism Unity, used it in his article Food and Culinary Tourism. The article changed into a book later on and contained useful information about tourism for students and activists of the field. Experts of demography maintain that foods and drinks have a special position in customs and temperaments of individuals. Thus, food is considered as a key element in demography, anthropology, and civilization. Food tourism has had a lucrative market for the past years. Approximately $200 billion of the world economy owes its profit to food tourism, and every tourist pays $150 to $200 for food during his travel. Iran is very rich in terms of food and drinks. This country enjoys one of the richest tablecloths in the world, with over 2,500 traditional and local foods and 109 drinks. Iranian cuisine has been the third known cuisine in the world after the Chinese and Roman ones. The variety of food in Iran is very high, and every region and ethnicity has its own specific food and drink. Many of these ethnicities and subcultures have numerous foods and drinks. For sure, climate variety is an effective factor in the structure and ingredients of foods. Iranians, in addition to various foods and drinks, enjoy specific customs and traditions for cooking, eating, and drinking them. This has its roots in the ancient culture of this nation. Well, that marks the end of this episode. Thanks for being with us, and God bless you.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. IRIB English Radio. visit us at parstoday.ir/en.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of The Subcontinent.
The Subcontinent.
Hello everyone, and welcome to another episode of The Subcontinent, a weekly show that aims to address the most significant issues in the South Asian region that affect the governments, the community, and most importantly, the people. And in today's episode, we will be discussing two major issues pertaining to India's economy and the Kashmir situation. So, stay tuned.
In this special episode of The Subcontinent, we will discuss public procurement as part of a free trade agreement of India with different countries. And we shall also take a look at, contrary to the BJP claims, deterioration in the economic and security state of Jammu and Kashmir.
A free trade agreement pact signed between India and the UAE last year has set alarm bells ringing for the big Indian companies. Being India's third largest trading partner, New Delhi last year opened UAE's access to India's public procurement market, displaying a major shift in its trade policy stance. Exports benefiting from the India-UAE Free Trade Pact accounted for about 60% of New Delhi's total non-oil shipments to Abu Dhabi in the December quarter last year.
The India-UAE Comprehensive Economic Partnership Agreement aims to increase bilateral trade to $100 billion from the current $60 billion in the next 5 years. The UAE is currently the third largest trading partner of India and second largest export destination. After keeping the public procurement market out of FTAs for a long time, India recently opened up access to public tenders over $2 billion to foreign companies as part of the negotiations. Big Indian business houses now face the challenge of foreign competition in acquiring government contracts as Delhi has extended national treatment to the UAE companies. Experts say that maintaining the $2 billion limit will safeguard small and medium-sized industries from the pressure of foreign competition.
We see basically moves that are playing out which seem to be calculated to give a fundamental business advantage to Atlantic world corporations which are no longer able to compete with emerging economies. So when these deals are done, It's basically kowtowing again to Uncle Sam and the British and the French, and for that matter, Israel and the Economic Union, which have, of course, have had over 500 years of dominance to get things right and have done nothing but mess up. And I have to confess, as a person of European descent, you know, I'm part of that and I'm taking the benefit of it. But it's time for a change. And the kind of change that's required is not breaking down traditional values in regional countries and clearing the way or so that multinational corporations from the United States and Great Britain and Europe more generally can come in and do business with billionaires in places like India, so that at the top end of the human scrap heap, They're lapping it all up and doing well and saying GDP is growing, while people at the bottom are suffering more than ever with rising prices and lower wages. So I don't think this is the way to go. I see it happening around the world. I see it happening here in Indonesia. I see a calculated effort to break down traditional values and clear the way with false promises for Western corporations to come in and cover the field and establish monopolies and oligopolies that basically put small businesses out of business.
According to Indian economists, foreign firms won't be able to compete with the local firms, thus incurring higher costs compared to national companies. Underwater structure projects involving large-scale medical equipment or artificial intelligence are the areas where the foreign companies have an edge over the local businesses. Cost being the major factor, the competition in majority of sectors is with ASEAN countries or China. As per the agreement, procurement has been open to UAE companies in 34 central government ministries, including Ministry of Economic Affairs, New and Renewable Energy, Power, etc.
Allowing access to the UAE to procure government tenders has resulted in the opening of the floodgates to similar demands from other countries India is negotiating with. These include the European Union, the UK and Australia. The agreement with the UAE is being used as a benchmark by other negotiating countries. Additionally, countries with which India already has FTAs may push for including access to $500 billion Indian government procurement market in the agreements.
In a surprising move, India and the European Union resumed negotiations in June 2022 for a free trade agreement after almost a decade. EU's demands include inclusion of concessions extended to other FTA partners, namely UAE, along with duty cuts on automobiles, dairy products. India also has ongoing talks with the UK, Australia, and Canada. All these countries are eyeing the Indian central government procurement market. According to the Indian government officials, the UK and EU will not negotiate if the public procurement market is kept out of the trade talks. Australia has also been asking for similar access as given to the UAE.
Well, I think it's very difficult to ever conceive of a situation that has large corporations facing a threat from smaller, more efficient companies. I don't think the business sector, the private sector works that way. The way corporatism works, basically, is huge corporations come into a country, whether it's by making promises or through corrupt payments or whatever it takes, and initially perform in order to be able to say, look, we're delivering a better product at a lower price, which helps everybody, including consumers. But once they've established themselves, they're like a caterpillar or a moth. They metamorphosize into something horrible that destroys all other possibilities, including local smaller businesses. It's very difficult for small businesses to survive, let alone threaten the supremacy of big corporations in a place where corporations have been allowed to come in and basically dominate the roost. So I don't see there being a scenario once these multinational corporations start coming in and doing trade with India, which understandably is primarily concerned about its own economic interests, that sees ordinary small businesses and medium-sized businesses and domestic businesses and individuals protected from what's going to play out. This is all part of the grander scheme for U.S. hegemony, or if you like, Atlantic world hegemony, where everybody's dancing to a set of rules that's drafted in America.
According to the experts, if a national treatment clause is included in the FTAs, it would mean similar treatment to foreign small companies. Given that foreign micro, small, and medium enterprises are very strong, it would create stiff competition for their domestic counterparts. The economists regard this as the real cause of concern, as providing a particular area means agreement to give access to other areas. Public procurement, being a huge market, is always preferred. In both scenarios, Indian businesses face danger of foreign entities entering the domestic market and increasing competition.
So we have discussed public procurement as part of free trade agreements of India with different countries. Now, let's switch to social media and see what people around the world had to say on this issue.
Let's now take a look at what the global media has to say about it. Mark Warner tweeted, "Public procurement of contracts worth over 200 crore rupees were opened up in the FTA signed with the UAE last year, and now every country India is negotiating with, including the EU, UK and Australia, is gunning for access to the public procurement market." John G. Murphy, an economic expert, wrote, "UK expects to strike FTA with India and accede to TPP in 2023, reports Bloomberg. The administration's view that FTAs are passé is a lonely one." Shantanu Singh, an economist, tweeted, "People aware of the development said that Indian companies, especially those in the IT sector, have also sought access to the public procurement market in the EU and the UK." Mint, a news portal, wrote, "The inclusion of public procurement in the UAE agreement marked a first for India, which has been notoriously shy of opening up this lucrative market to foreign companies."
You're listening to The Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to The Subcontinent every Monday here on IRIB English Radio.
Contrary to the claims of the Modi-led BJP government, the intensity of attacks on the civilian population in Jammu and Kashmir has increased in recent years. These attacks have mainly been aimed on the minority Kashmiri Pandit community and the non-resident Hindus living in Kashmir. Experts say that the armed group's strategy to attack the non-locals and minorities is a way to signal opposition to the means employed by the Bharatiya Janata Party to change the demography of the Muslim-majority region.
With the start of the new year, the state of Jammu and Kashmir witnessed the killing of four civilians in the Rajouri district by unidentified gunmen. Two more people, including a child, died the following day when a blast rocked the area. Conflicting with the return of normalcy as claimed by the BJP government, at least 18 non-local Hindus and Kashmiri Pandits have been killed since the abrogation of Article 370. According to the data provided by the government of India, the violence has seen no downward trend since the revocation of the statehood in the year 2019. The Modi-led BJP government had cited the special status of Jammu and Kashmir as the primary reason for violence. 229 armed attacks were recorded in the year 2021, leading to 40 civilian killings. The number went to 30 civilian killings in the year 2022. In the years 2017 and 2016, 279 and 322 attacks were reported, thus showing no significant improvement in the situation, as wrongly portrayed by New Delhi. The central BJP government has been asserting that the abrogation of Article 370 brought normalcy to the violence-ridden region. However, the opposite appears to be true. In the year 2013, prior to Modi's coming to power, only 170 cases of violence were reported from the Himalayan region.
Contrary to the popular belief that the COVID-19 pandemic has wreaked havoc to the economy of Jammu and Kashmir, statistics show a different picture. After the abrogation of Article 370, the investments in the region dropped from $72.3 million in 2018-2019 to $36.3 million in the year 2019-2020. According to the government of India's recent figures, the investment has decreased by more than 50% since the revocation of the special status of the Himalayan region.
The claim that the abrogation of the semi-autonomous status of the state will lead to economic development in the region has failed on the ground. Last year in December, India's Minister of State for Home Affairs, Nityanand Rai, gave figures about the economic status of Jammu and Kashmir. According to the statistics, the investments in the region have fallen by 55% in the past 4 years. Previously blaming the local governments for the economic backwardness in the region, the BJP government in New Delhi has not been able to put the Union Territory directly ruled by the center on the road to economic development as had been promised earlier. According to the data published by the Indian Ministry of Home Affairs, the total investment in the year 2017 to 2018 was $102.8 million, considerably decreasing to $50.5 million in the year 2019 to 2022. And in 2021 to 2022, the investments were recorded to be $46 million, thus laying bare the false claims of economic growth in the region. Earlier, Modi-led BJP government would cite restrictions on the procurement of land as the main reason for economic backwardness of the Himalayan region. However, after the abrogation of Article 370, the government still has not been able to bring private sector investment to the state, thus ruining the economy further.
Now, to have more insight on this, we are joined by Mr. Abdullah Khan from Islamabad. He's the Managing Director of Pakistan Institute for Conflict and Security Studies. Thank you for being on the program, sir. Now, contrary to the rosy picture painted by the BJP government, the civilian killings of the non-resident Hindus and Kashmir Pandits have increased. So the question is, do you think the armed groups have changed their tactics after the abrogation of Article 370?
First of all, we all should condemn the killing of civilian for whatever pretext somebody is doing this. Nobody can justify killings of civilians by any means, whether they are Pandits or non-Kashmiri residents or whoever. Having said this, that I think that the civilian Pandits, Kashmiri Pandits, or the non-resident Kashmiris are being made cannon fodder by the Indian government. Indian government has a plan to change the demography of occupied state of Jammu and Kashmir. For that, they are bringing in non-Kashmiris in the state of Jammu and Kashmir. And they have changed not just the state of the disputed state, but also they have changed the laws about domiciles and the residents. So that has enabled them to bring non-resident Kashmiris. And by doing this, actually the BJP government is fueling tension between different religions. So because the demographic changes being made in Kashmir are based on the religion, because predominantly Kashmir is a Muslim majority state, and which should have been something India could have taken pride in that it has a state which is majority Muslim state, and that suited the Indian claim of secularism. But since the BJP is in power, which is a Hindu fascist and nationalist government, they are trying to change the demography on the basis of Hindu Muslims. So they are bringing in more Hindus, and which are actually creating troubles for the Hindu Pandits, which are Kashmiris and very much state subject. They lived there for centuries, and they used to have very cordial relations with the Muslim majority of the state of Jammu and Kashmir. But now they are also in trouble because of these political policies of BJP, which will not only backfire within Kashmir, but elsewhere in India as well.
Now, Mr. Khan, citing the special status as a roadblock to the economic development of the region, statistics show that investments in the region have fallen by 55%. Now, conflicting with the claims, has the withdrawal of the special status been responsible for the decrease in economic investments?
Hey, you know, this is very interesting that the BJP says that after abrogation of special status to Kashmir, they will bring in investment, while destroying the economy of Kashmiri traders and Kashmiri businessmen for almost now 10 years, consistently destroying the local economy. How can you actually improve the economic condition of the state, the people of the state? This is, I think, not understandable to common sense, that local economy, you know, the blockade of the Kashmiri traders, it remained for months. And the Kashmir is practically in siege for almost 2 years now, and 2.5 years now. And you claim that you will bring investment, and that is not possible. And as you mentioned, the statistics have shown that it is not possible. Actually, it is hypocrisy at its best. Whatever the BJP government is trying to do in Kashmir is actually to strengthen its occupation. And for that, their sole objective is to weaken the will of the local people by whatever means. And they are trying to bring in, as I earlier mentioned, non-resident people. And now they are trying to bring in the business community of India into Kashmir while depriving the local businessmen of their own businesses. This is ridiculous. You cannot actually prosper as a state or a territory while the local people are deprived of their basic livelihoods and you are bringing in other investors. That's not possible. And this is the, this is the basic objective the Modi had presented Kashmir as a business hub for non-resident business community to come in and to benefit from the tourism and other businesses available in Kashmir. And the sole objective is actually to destroy the local businesses. Now, I think that will not work. Whatever India try, that will not work for India and not for the people of the Kashmir.
Mr. Khan, we've seen that violence in the region has not improved in the past few years, as claimed by the BJP government. So has the centre's iron fist policy turned counterproductive in the Himalayan region?
History is a teacher, but we tend not to listen from it, not to learn from it. Everybody knows that you cannot crush the will of the people by iron fist or whatever strict policies you adopt. This is not for the first time India is adopting very strict policies. India killed more than 100,000 people in Kashmir, but the Kashmiri people never, ever, bore down in front of Indian pressure. They still demand their right of self-determination, and this is the will of the people. You know, India uses sometimes stick, sometimes carrot policy for the people of Kashmir. Sometimes they try to appease them, sometimes they try to coerce them. But both have failed in the past and both will fail in the past, in future as well, because the people of Jammu and Kashmir want to have their right of self-determination. And India should actually give them their the opportunity to exercise their right, which India itself had committed under the UN Security Council resolutions. And it was basically India which took Kashmir issue into United Nations, not Pakistan. India was losing the war at that time because the Kashmiri people had taken up arms, and this Azad Kashmir and Gilgit-Baltistan, that was liberated by the people. And India was fearful that Srinagar was about to fall, and when India took that to UN Security Council, now India is obliged to fulfill its own commitments at international forums, which India is denying and which will cost India miserably in the future.
Now, Mr. Khan, last but not least, the incidence of violence in Kashmir has seen a downward trend before Modi's coming to power. So the question is, has the anti-Muslim policy of the BJP further alienated the people of the region and pushed them to the wall?
Actually, if we see the violence of the Kashmiri militant groups against the Indian state, that is irrespective of who is in power in the center, whether it is BJP, whether it is Congress, whether it is a united front of different political parties. The Kashmiri people are actually resistant against the occupation of India, and they want to exercise their right of self-determination, which was deprived by India. So the basic thing is that the militant groups, they will carry their work, whether it is BJP, whether it is some other government. But having said that, the strict policies which BJP has applied on Kashmir, it actually help the militant groups to recruit more and more Kashmiri youth. There was a time that then there was a mix of non-Kashmiri and Kashmiri militants. Now we are seeing that majority of the militants operating in Kashmir are purely the Kashmiri youth. So that is a phenomena which changed during the BJP's government, that more youth is being radicalized in Kashmir and they are joining different militant groups. And this is for the first time in the history of Kashmir that that during BJP's government, we have seen the presence of Daesh in Kashmir and we have seen presence of Al-Qaeda in Kashmir. It never happened. So that is the level of, suppression and depression among the Kashmiri youth, which can actually become catastrophic for India and for the region as well. So that is something which is new in Kashmir, and that is the result of the BJP's policies.
There you have it, Mr. Abdullah Khan from Islamabad. He's the managing director of Pakistan Institute for Conflict and Security Studies. Thank you for being on the program, sir. Now, let's see how people have reacted on social media.
Sharp Media Network tweeted, "No developments in Indian illegally occupied Jammu and Kashmir during last 4 years. The last 4 years have ruined the entire economy of Jammu and Kashmir, which has in reality collapsed. Unemployment is at its peak and youth is in utter frustration." Frontier Indica wrote, "It's no secret that under Modi, the security situation in Punjab has gotten much worse, and the benefits of revocation of Article 370 vis-a-vis the safety of common people in J&K, especially KPs, have also been short-lived." The Wire, a prominent news portal, tweeted, "The people of Kashmir say silence, fear."